Well, it's a historic result. After a battle lasting more than a year, and it's the outcome we've all been waiting for. That's right, Virgin Media and Sky have kissed and made up. We'll be discussing that later on in this week's Media Talk. Also on the podcast, as Barack Obama is swept into the White House, how was it for the media? Never mind the bollocks, Michael Grade calls for a halt to unnecessary bad language on TV. And Jane Bruton says grazie. The woman in charge of the top-selling glossy is named Magazine Editor's Editor of the Year. I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. Now, my guests for this week's Media Talk are our media correspondent, Owen Gibson. Owen, we said the last time you were on that this would be your last podcast, but this is definitely going to be our last podcast.
Definitely, definitely. Peter Mandelson's star return, but no, this is definitely my last one.
Going off to be sports news correspondent. Maggie Brown, what time did you stay up to on election night?
I did something very odd. I went to bed at 8, I got up at midnight, and then I kept going in and out and watching things.
It's actually nearer what I did, then, but that was for work reasons. Well, let's start this week with a bit of history.
John Bolton, I said I'd come back to you about the perceptions abroad of an Obama presidency and how it will change.
Well, first I'll give you a perception from America. You should fire that reporter that you just had on in Colorado. That man wasn't conducting an interview, he was having an argument.
All right, well, you've had your say. We're joined now from Los Angeles by the distinguished author and observer of American politics, Gore Vidal.
Republican Party is a mindset. They're out to hang on to all the connections that they have.
Are you saying you thought that there would be dirtier tricks played in this campaign than materialized in reality? Is that what you're saying?
I hinted at that. I thought you would take the hint and not take it as a statement of reality.
Why shouldn't I take it as a statement of reality?
I don't know why you would, because I don't know who you are.
Well, I know who you are, Mr. Vidal, and you were...
Well, you're one up on me.
We're also going to be joined in a moment or two by Dizzy Rascal, the well-known rapper.
I'd like to ask Dizzy Rascal, Mr. Rascal, do you feel yourself to be British?
Of course I'm British, man. You know me. I'm here, man. What's good?
Well, why don't you run for office?
See, that's a very good idea. I might have to do that one day still. Dizzy Rascal for Prime Minister, yeah? Sat in.
Those were some of the highlights of the election coverage from this side of the Atlantic. It was a momentous week. So how did the media shape up? Owen, I mean, it was extraordinary amount of coverage, wasn't it? Almost more than for a UK election.
It was incredible. I mean, you could, particularly if you had if you lived in a sort of multi-channel home and being able to flip between BBC One, ITV, and then onto all the US
CNN.
News channels, CNN, Fox News, and you got a brilliant kind of whenever you got a bit bored, it was good fun, good sport just to switch on Fox News and sort of see their sort of confused and slightly begrudging handling of the whole thing. And the highlight of the night, of course, the CNN hologram.
Just completely bizarre. I thought it was a wonderful talking point. In fact, I wasn't at the CNN party, which I nearly went to, partly because I thought I was losing my voice. But when I stayed at home and I actually watched the CNN coverage, on election nights, I never bother with the British channels, so I'm a bit of a bad person to talk to about the hopelessness of ITV or the pedestrian nature of the BBC coverage.
You're even without watching it, that's absolutely right, isn't it? Well done, Maggie.
But long experience has taught me that since, we're 20 years now into the multi-channel revolution, it's far, far better to watch the American channels. And CNN had a very good night. I actually like the Beam Me Up, Scotty ghostly visitation.
I just thought it was one of those things that was, from a technological point of view, astonishing and it looked amazing. But then editorially, utterly useless.
Completely pointless.
But, if you actually want to attract, say, a teenager to watch, it had this wonderful... That's what my teenager...
I think there were other things about the election that hopefully make us
feel I agree with Owen. Can I just say something? At the end of the day, it doesn't actually really matter which network you were watching because Obama's acceptance
Well, it was the same results, funnily enough, on each
was
one.
Was incredible. The actual story took over any of the plans or designs of any of the networks. It was just a wow kind of experience.
It was an amazing speech.
I think that's
right.
But for such a momentous night, it did just feel that both BBC and ITV just felt completely undercooked. I agree with Sam Wollaston, who sort of said Dimbleby,
I think. Do you know what I thought after it? I thought it's maybe we need to start succession planning for David Dimbleby in terms of the UK election.
In my opinion, Justin Webber's had a fantastic American election, and I mean he also wrote a brilliant book about America, which came out just a couple of weeks ago about the actual nature of this huge, huge country. And I think he's actually been, in British terms, the absolute star of the election.
Mm. There were some brilliant moments in the BBC election coverage. We heard them in the highlights package there. But Gore Vidal saying to David Imbri, I have no idea who you are. And John Bolton, the former George Bush appointed ambassador to the UN, calling for Rajesh Mirchandani to be sacked, which is probably quite reasonable, actually. That's the broadcasters' coverage. But the newspapers as well have been astonishing. You know, special pullouts and I mean, it wouldn't have happened, Owen, if the results had gone the other way, would it?
There was a lot of very relieved people, I think, not only in Fleet Street, but also if you looked at sort of the weekly news magazines, Spectator and New Statesman today, they had page after page of Obama, and you just think that, you know, there must have been a lot of relieved faces the morning after, because, you know, you're right, if it had been McCain, I think the best laid plans would have...
Yeah, there were special pullouts and commemorative supplements all over the place.
It's been fantastic for newspapers. I mean, if you've been... I've been touring a couple of newsagents locally in my part of the woods. They've been telling me the papers are flying off the shelves. People, and a woman came in while I was buying some extra copies today saying, you didn't deliver my paper, you know, and it was absolutely, I have to have my souvenir paper. And you know, she walked out with a treasured
paper. One of those really heartening moments, isn't it, where you realise that people do still want a newspaper on a big news day. You know, they've watched the rolling news coverage, they've been online, they've got all the great interactive graphics and everything, but they still want to read the analysis. They want to know what it means. You know?
But of course, because of the timing for UK newspaper websites, was that it fell very well. And I'm imagining, you know, I mean, I've seen the Guardian figures, which were, you know, hugely up, and I'm sure it's the same for all the other UK online sites as well. That it will have brought a lot of people. Audience online as well.
Well, in many ways, it's the perfect synthesis, I think, of online and newspaper, because, you know, kind of a lot of people did stay up, but they did track it they may have had their laptop in front of them while they were watching the TV coverage, and then they got up the next day and bought the newspaper. And I think when it works like that, it works brilliantly.
Don't forget, guardian.co.uk/US elections has all the results and the fallout from the Obama victory if you want more. I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk, still to come.
I want you to watch what we're about to do, because you've never seen anything like this on television.
Hi, Wolf.
All right, big round of applause. We did it. There she is. We beamed you in.
That's the sound of money being poured down the drain. Anna Pickard will take us through the highlights and holograms with a cheeky peek at the US coverage of the American elections. And arriving shortly on this platform, Virgin viewers get another look at the sky. But next, there's a spot of bother in the kitchen.
I do this all the time. This hour I run my fucking restaurant. It's not true.
That's why you're in this shit, fucking fat idiot.
Don't call me fat. You are a twat. Do you know that?
You stupid,
jumped-up
idiot.
Fucking silly
you're
looking...
This is how you run your business, is
you're
it?
You're a fucking knob.
That's a scene from Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, which, if Michael Grade had his way, would be forced to cut out all the effing and blinding. Speaking at a Broadcasting Press Guild lunch this week, he said that TV used the F-word too indiscriminately.
I do think that the prevalence of bad language, the F-word, etc., on TV is a little unrestrained. I'm not calling for it to be banned under any circumstances, but I don't think we take enough care over the use of the F-word and similar words. You know, it used to be that you had to get very, very senior sign-off to be able to use that word in a show without bleeping it. I'm not sure what the rules are these days. Clearly, not enough consideration is given to a very large section of the audience who perhaps don't want to hear such words. You therefore have to know why you're using it and give it a little bit of extra consideration. Seems to me rather indiscriminate now.
Owen and Maggie, you were both at that Broadcasting Press Guild lunch. Maggie, what did you make of what he had to say? Was that a significant intervention, do you think, on language?
I thought it was a little bit half-hearted, because he also said he didn't really know what the guidelines or what the current practice was. At ITV, and he would have to have a word, which he hasn't already had yet, with his director of television obviously, you know, the key person involved, Peter Fincham.
Was he trying, Owen, do you think, to desperately get journalists to talk about something else other than the poor performance of ITV?
There was a little bit of look over there about it, wasn't there? And I think there was also a little bit of follow-up of you know, he'd obviously been ruminating slightly on the brand Ross stuff. And I think, you know, just talking anecdotally to people, some might say he's got a point. If you watch kind of a Jamie Oliver or Gordon Ramsay, do they need to... effing blind every 2 minutes. But at the same time, he wasn't really even talking about mainstream channels like ITV1 and BBC1, which don't feature a huge amount of...
I don't know. That Jonathan Ross show is pretty blue, don't you think? All sorts of.
Well, it is at 10:30. I think of more concern used to be his Radio 2 show, which was on Saturday morning. And of course, there isn't any restriction or any kind of watershed on radio, so you've got different problems. I think one of the things that's happened actually is that there has been a deterioration in standards. And there hasn't been any particular monitoring of that by the broadcasters concerned. They've been fighting all sorts of other things. And to some extent, big channels like BBC One and maybe BBC Two, certainly ITV One, they do have to be very careful because they actually do aim full square at the mainstream audience. Mm. And so there is a quite fluid debate going on about what's acceptable. And I think it is a bit unnecessary for Jamie Oliver to be quite so foul-mouthed at 9 o'clock. I don't see the point in it.
Well,
only food, isn't it?
Yeah. There's been quite a lot of comment already on mediaguardian.co.uk. Derek 500 makes the... Well, I think it's a very good point. You'll appreciate this, Maggie. That programmes like Big Brother's Little Brother cross-promote what's on after the watershed.
Exactly.
So in an earlier show, you'll get a huge amount of promotion for a later show, which then kids presumably will want to watch, which is then, you know, it's not designed for them, is it?
No, I agree with you.
It's the sort of subject that, you know, kind of, that broadcasters would typically have shied away from probably before the Ross Brand stuff for not wanting to appear foggyish and out of touch. But in the sort of post... Ross Brand climate. It seemed like a fairly sensible thing for Gray to raise, just like Maggie. I wish he'd done so slightly more forcefully and slightly more of a point of view. He seemed to sort of raise it and then back away from it, didn't he? And it did make it seem like it was something he was throwing up
What I thought was interesting was the point he made there about Jonathan Ross, that they wouldn't want him on the Comedy Awards because the show would be all about him.
Yeah,
and that's real problem.
Yes, he made it clear at the lunch Gray did that it was clearly the ITV's decision not to have him.
That's right. And secondly, he wasn't sure anymore whether he would use him in a live or quasi-live event.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting thing. What he's actually saying about Ross is Ross has to find a way, if he can, to win back a mainstream audience who will trust him on a big ITV1 channel, even with the Comedy Awards. And that's a huge challenge for him.
Do we have anything interesting to say about ITV's financial statement this week and the merger of the consumer division?
Well, I thought the fact that they've rolled online into their main broadcasting division was interesting, if only because it's so overdue. And, you know, going back to the Charles Allen era, the two big things that were overlooked by Charles Allen as he was desperately trying to crunch all these ITV franchises together was, one, new media. They completely missed the ball on, you know, kind of anything to do with building up their website or their digital division, and global production, which they've now belatedly realised just kind of holds the key to their survival. So, I mean, I think, you know, kind of as a continuation of the ITV story, it was quite a sort of significant moment, but of course overshadowed by the fact that their revenues continue to plunge and the advertising market looks completely bleak. So, I mean, it's still tough times.
On that point, I was at the Advertising Effectiveness Awards on Monday, which the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising have every couple of years, and I happen to be sitting next to some very big names in the industry, and I can tell you the atmosphere is incredibly gloomy, and everything that we've seen from the ITV statement about it getting worse and not picking up, deteriorating further next year, all of that is just replicated across the industry. These are really, really grim times. And I think actually that in some ways he's attempting, for example, to talk up the video on demand and the online activities that they're now benefiting from in order desperately to find a growth story somewhere.
And that's still such a minor part of their business as it stands.
£25 million,
I mean, of course, it's where the future lies, but it's just tiny.
Well, on the blog, Collective Thinking wonders if Grade will stop ITV's US production arm producing Hell's Kitchen with Gordon effing Ramsay for Fox, and will ITV2 stop importing it back to the UK? Not fucking likely. Leave your thoughts on the site. More details at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. It was the British Society of Magazine Editors Awards this week, and the top gong, the Editor's Editor Award, went to Jane Bruton of Grazia magazine. Jane Bruton, congratulations. How are you feeling?
Thank you. Oh, it's an amazing feeling. I can't believe it. I'm still pinching myself. So humbling, well, you know, being voted for by your peers.
What makes a good magazine editor, Jane, do you think?
it's all about building the right team around you and inspiring confidence in that team, really. We all love what we do, and the passion that people have for the product is absolutely amazing. Confidence for me is the key to everything, because if I inspire confidence in the people I work with, that's when I get the best ideas back. I've got a very strong vision for the magazine, but you know, I need a great team to make that happen, and it's very important to me that I listen to all voices, not just the loudest ones. You know, some of the best ideas in the magazine come from really stupid conversations, so they're just as important as kind of like serious meetings. You know, we have a lot of fun meetings at Grazia, and I think that's what makes it work.
Grazia is all about shopping and fashion and all those sorts of things, of course, and I wonder what effect is the economic downturn going to have on magazines like yours that are about consumerism?
Well, I think we're about a lot more than that, actually. I think the reason people love Grazia is because of the mix, and we've done a big piece on the Congo today. But obviously, yeah, fashion is really key to us. I think people are changing how they shop. I mean, we've just done a shopping survey, actually, here while we've been at Westfield to find out about how people are thinking. And what we found is that they're thinking a lot harder about how they shop. So that instead of kind of like, you know, rushing off to buy the latest it buy and coming out of shops with like bag loads of stuff that they haven't even tried on, you know, they might be kind of like shopping around a lot more, thinking harder about how they put a look together. But, you know, they're loving that. People aren't shopping less. In fact, I think we found that they're going shopping more. They might be buying less, or they might be buying more sort of key quality items, but they're thinking a lot harder about it. And I think they're enjoying that.
You mentioned you're at Westfield. This is this huge new shopping centre in West London. And what exactly are you doing down there?
It's a completely mad idea to celebrate the launch of the biggest shopping centre in any city in Europe. We've just decamped here. There's like 46 of us with our computers. You know, we left on the office last Friday in our normal office, all came into Westfield on Monday morning. We're in this pod right in the middle of the shopping centre. It felt like we're in this kind of like big surreal dream, really, because it's quite noisy here, so you have to kind of like shout quite a lot. So that's been quite hard work, but it's been an amazing bonding experience for the team as well. I mean, it's been a bit like being on a week-long school trip, and the hardships that we've had to kind of overcome have really brought us together. But in another way, it's been absolutely brilliant, because we've been talking to readers non-stop all week and getting their input into the magazine.
What about trends in magazines? Where do you see magazines going, particularly the women's titles?
It's going to be really, really tough, I think, over the next year or so. My feeling is that we might see a new genre or a new, you know, something really creative coming out of that, because I think out of times of recession, it forces people to be creative. And I think it's quite interesting to see what's happening fashion-wise, because I think a lot of people have almost lost a bit of confidence for a little time. But I think now what we're going to see is great, you know, amazing creativity coming through.
Grazia's Jane Bruton there. Maggie, are you a Grazia? I don't really have you down as a Grazia woman.
Yes, well,
No,
I'm not stylish enough, but I'm too old. But I read it when I go to the hairdressers, and it is extremely user friendly.
She's done a brilliant job
on quite a difficult concept. But mind you, she's done it at a time when everybody's just loved to go shopping.
Perhaps now, at the time of economic downturn, maybe
there's one argument, though, isn't there, that says that in times of economic downturn, magazines do better because people can't afford to go out and buy shoes and handbags, so they like to read about them instead.
There we are.
Maybe you're right.
Excellent stuff.
This is Sky News. It's 7 o'clock.
Live from the Sky News Centre, this is Sky News.
Now, that's not something that Virgin Media subscribers will have heard recently after their spat just over a year ago that led to Sky Channel being dropped from Virgin. But they're all friends again now. Sky News, Sky 1, 2 and 3 and Sky Sports News will be returning to the screens of cable TV customers next week. The two companies have successfully renegotiated their agreements to be carried on each other's platforms. So what does this mean, Owen? It's a long time coming. Which should never have happened in the first place.
You had a Dimbleby moment with your script.
I was having a Dimbleby moment with my script. Yes, yeah, sorry about that.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if you remember how vicious this spat was originally, you know, they were taking out full page ads against each other in the national press. They were briefing really heavily against one another through the papers, and it was really vicious. But the main thing that's happened is the change in tone, really, since James Murdoch made way for Jeremy Darroch at Sky, and both companies have been trying to ever since since, really, trying to find a way back and trying to find a mutually acceptable way of resolving this. And the way they've resolved it, basically, is, Virgin have said to Sky, we'll pay you more for your channels. And Sky have said to Virgin, oh, and by the way, we'll pay you a bit more for yours as well. So they've both been able to walk away feeling as though they haven't completely capitulated. But obviously, it's good news for viewers. But I think it also says some interesting things about the sort of shifting pay TV landscape as well.
Well, I mean, it's true, Maggie, that Virgin, although we were not long ago, all the commentators were saying that cable is a basket case and the old NTL would never last. But Virgin, you know, they look as if they are starting slowly to turn it around, don't they?
Well, Neil Burkitt was confirmed as chief executive, and he's taken a view that the future does really lie in the fact that they've got half the country wired with, good cable, which they can put super fast broadband on, and that is the future.
Well, interesting.
And they have a good sell. You know, they have something to offer.
Well, it's the iPlayer, I think. It's Virgin Media. I'm a Virgin Declaration of Interest. I'm a Virgin Media subscriber, but we have now Virgin in the main room because you can have the iPlayer through the television, and you know, you pay what, 40 quid a month, and you get the full package, not the sport, but you get the next level of package of all the channels apart from the sport. And I get 20 meg broadband and I get a telephone. Now, if I had just the BT landline and the 20 meg broadband, that would have cost me 40 quid. So it's a really good
proposition. So what did you do with your Sky?
Well, my Sky Plus is in the back room now.
But, I mean, Neil Burkitt has been very clever because what he's done is said, we're not going to compete with Sky for all those big money football rights. We're not going to even play in the field of big name content. We're not really going to go and compete against them for the losts of this world. But what we're going to do is put a big bet on broadband, because that's where our advantage lies. And it's kind of working for him. But that iPlayer advantage will decrease. That is, at the moment, it's a real key, you know, significant differentiator for them, but that will disappear as iPlayer goes onto other platforms and comes onto Freeview and all the rest of it.
I assume that it'll go onto Freeview at some point.
You're right. I mean, there are moves to get it onto Freeview boxes, I reckon, within the next sort of 18 months.
What struck me, though, looking at the most recent quarterly figures from the Virgin Media Group, was the fact that their churn is so low. I mean, just over 1% compared with over 10% for Sky. And so they must be doing something right. There must be lots of people like you, Matt, who feel very satisfied with the deal they've got.
I was just going to, before we move on, I was going to address a point that was made on the blog last week. Lucien Desguy, I hope I've pronounced your online name properly, said he was very complimentary about last week's programme, but said that there was a lack of mentions about licence fee top slicing and Channel 4. So I think we should correct that now. In the context, Owen, of your interview with Jeremy Hunt, the Tories.
Two of our favourite subjects, of course, Maggie. Yes,
absolutely. So we'll try not to deal with it for too long. But did he say anything interesting in your interview that gives us a clue as to what Tory broadcasting policy will be? Because obviously there's a chance, or there's almost likelihood, that they will form the next government.
I mean, the Conservatives are in a really interesting place because on the one hand, they know they can't take the traditional Tory view of, you know, let's decimate the BBC, let's privatise Channel 4. Mm. You know, they recognise that the licence fee is a good thing, that different forms of funding are a good thing, that Channel 4 is a good thing. But I think that they're like Ofcom and everybody else, they're finding it hard to get away, to square the circle, if you like, and work out where the money will come from to prop up Channel 4, to provide competition in local and regional news, which is another thing Jeremy Hunt is very big on. So, I mean, I think inevitably they're going to end up coming back round to top slicing. And it's true to say that they are kind of more ideologically inclined towards it than Labour.
But he didn't come down on which of the Ofcom options he was going to come for.
No, he was still quite equivocal. And I think that was where the weakness lies in his strategy as it is at the moment. I mean, he's very plausible, he's very convincing, but as soon as you try to get onto any of the detail, he kind of shies away from it and says, I'm waiting for Ofcom to decide, or I'm waiting for Andy Burnham to decide. And really, that's not really good enough at this stage of the debate. We're getting down to the hard yards, if you like, and he's really got to say, you know, what he would do, I think.
Interesting stuff also, Maggie, with David Cameron writing in The Sun this week, saying how that he watches a lot of the BBC, he even approves of how it's funded, but there was a but, wasn't there?
But there was a but. At the same time, he didn't actually appear to be agreeing with top slicing. He was saying, hand back the digital portion that everybody else has their eyes on, and saying, give it back to the taxpayer, which is, oddly enough, almost what Michael Grade has said, let the people decide. just to reinforce Owen's point, I was listening to Ed Vasey, who's the Tories' junior culture spokesman yesterday. And again, he was quite equivocal about what to do. I think the Tories don't really have a firm policy yet, but they have to follow the Cameron line. I personally think there are no votes in bashing the BBC. And I also think you have to look at Cameron. He's a father of young children. The value of CBeebies. The value of CBeebies. We underestimate this in opinion forming circles. Is quite enormous.
How can you say that there's no votes in bashing the BBC when 30,000 people complained to the BBC?
They complained because the BBC upsets them. But I don't actually think that there is.
It's out of love, is it?
I think out of sort of sadness that they've been let down by.
Disappointed.
That's the word. Yes.
All right. Well, listen. Thanks very much, Maggie, for your input, and thank you, Owen, for what presumably will now be your last time, unless there's a sports rights story in which we'll
indeed. We might make a guest appearance.
Absolutely. But. Thank you very much to Owen Gibson and Maggie Brown. Anna Pickard is next.
As we approach the hour, we're about to tell you something that you may have recognized was inevitable. It's now 11 o'clock. We project California for Barack Obama. That will change our electoral board from 220 votes to 275 and make Barack Obama, in our view, president-elect of the United States of America.
CBS projects that Senator Barack Obama of Illinois will be the next president of the United States.
We can report history.
Barack Obama is projected to be the next president of the United States of America. NBC News calling for the Democratic candidate.
Well, that was the result being called on the US networks earlier this week, and the woman in the know who was watching all of them was our own Anna Pickard, who was live blogging the coverage, and she joins us now. If you could see her, you'd see that she's joined me in the studio by hologram.
That's right, yes.
You look marvellous, Anna.
Please.
And it's the wonder of technology.
You're my only hope.
So this we were chatting about this hologram thing earlier and being very rude about it. It is the only topic of conversation, obviously, isn't it?
It's the most pointless thing ever. It was basically someone from Chicago talking to someone in New York and just saying exactly the same thing that she would say on one of these kind of, you know, normal flat cameras. Yeah. But saying it, you know, 4 feet away from him at 3/4 height. He couldn't see her.
She couldn't see him. We could see both of them, which is very exciting. But it completely destroyed the whole point of the exercise of those sorts of interviews, which is to see the reporter on location with all the people around them.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if they could have, you know, filmed Obama with their 40 cameras and 25 computers or whatever it was, and then projects him into my living room,
that would
giving
have been
cool. his acceptance speech, that would be brilliant, especially if he was then going to promise me a puppy. But no, they didn't. It was just one of their correspondents in their studio, completely pointlessly. We loved it. It was the highlight of the night, frankly.
It must have cost them an absolute fortune to actually make the viewing experience worse.
Ah, but Matt, all television will be like this one day. We've seen the future.
We have indeed. So listen, now the other thing that I wanted to ask you about was, how did the result go down on Fox News, the fair and balanced?
There were some sad faces. There were some glasses tipped to the end of the nose and a bit of kind of, you know, frowning. But eventually they started saying, you know what, we've always thought this Obama chap was a good man. And
we thought it was a great idea from the beginning.
We've liked him all along. And I, anyone who thought we weren't, we didn't, was completely wrong.
Excellent.
So good for them.
Now, did Katie Couric have any particular role in the night's proceedings?
I'm obsessed with Katie Couric. I can't
really
hear a word she's saying, just because she's so... I mean, she's very beautiful. And she's in soft focus. And I don't know whether it's just, you know, the way they choose to film her, or whether in fact, is, you know, kind of covered with a soft downy fur that makes the camera go all fuzzy when it looks at her. But she's amazing. You just kind of stare at her wondering why she, as a news anchor, is in soft focus and no one else is. So anything she said to me, anything, she could announce to me that the world was going to end and I would still kind of go, oh, Katie.
Now, did the BBC coverage, which of course they spent vast amounts of licence fee payers' money on and flying all sorts of correspondents everywhere, and David Dimbleby, did that have any impact at all there?
I'm afraid
or not?
It made no impact on me whatsoever. No. I couldn't even find it. But then that is because I do have 560,000 channels, and I mean, you have to understand that I'm used to elections going on all night, and because I'm in a stupid time zone, at about 9:30 the whole thing ended, and I kind of was like, "Oh, great, Obama's president, brilliant. What's on now? Law and Order."
Yes, the thing is, they cheat, though, don't they? In that they call the results before they've actually counted the votes.
That's
not real elections, is it? That's just guessing.
No, basically, as soon as California polls closed, and because they knew that everyone in California was going to vote for Obama, and they did, they called it at about 5 to 8. They started intimating that was going to happen, that they were going to call the election in 10 minutes' time, and it was all over 8 o'clock here, and it was just, you know, every single network called it at once, and that was it.
How boring. Now listen, are you in a position to judge who had the best coverage?
The hologram took it, but Wolf Blitzer.
Wolf Blitzer,
apart from having the best name on the planet,
this is CNN, isn't it? Yeah.
But CNN took it basically. I think they had the most kind of neutral and balanced coverage. ABC seemed to be reaching and trying to get everywhere at once, but CNN seemed to kind of actually just follow the story a lot closer.
The satellite is passing now, so I'm afraid. The hologram is, you're dematerialising as we speak, so we have to let you go before you disintegrate into little bits. Thank you very much, Anna Picard in San Francisco. And thank you very much to you for listening, because that's it for Media Talk in this eventful week. Do comment on any part of the podcast at our website, guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. There was a good mix of analysis, gossip and healthy scepticism about anything we said on the blog last week, so do keep it up this week. Thank you. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. I'm Matt Wells. See you again soon.